First now to a provocative idea about how we could view the world, not via the lens of nations, but by megacities and economic zones, about 50 of them, not by borders on a map, but by transport lines and communications networks, where power's not just measured by those with the most powerful military, but by the best connected to the rest of the world. It's all about connectography, as my first guest this hour calls it. I'll let him fully outline what he means by this term in a moment, but in a nutshell, it's about how connectivity and geography will affect the future of global affairs. Parag Khanna is a senior research fellow at the National University of Singapore at its Lee Kuan Yew School of Public Policy. He's held various positions at universities and institutions like the Brookings, and he was an advisor to the UN Special Operations in Iraq and Afghanistan. He's compiled his ideas and some very interesting maps in his book Connectography, Mapping the Global Network Revolution. Parag joins me from Singapore via Skype. Welcome.
Thank you so much. Great to be with you.
So how do you define connectography, if I'm pronouncing it properly?
Well, it's a neologism of mine, so actually you're entitled to pronounce it any way you like. We've got some focus groups on the pronunciation. I call it connectography, and by which I mean the fusion of connectivity and geography. You know, there's this ancient adage, geography is destiny. Mm. And I believe that that does have to be modified to connectivity is destiny, because we have taken our physical geography and built on top of it these network infrastructures of transportation, energy, and communications. Think of every railway and pipeline and internet cable that wraps the globe like a ball of yarn. Our maps don't typically contain those things, even though we are the ones who actually built them. So what I'm addressing is this incredible irony, and it really shapes, as maps do, the way we think about the world. So I'm out to create maps that demonstrate how connected the world is rather than how divided it is by political borders.
You say, to distill it for listeners, there are more accurate maps of the world. There should be more accurate maps of the world. 200 discrete nations, or should they be replaced by 50 major megacities with dense connectivity connecting them rather than borders that actually divide them? Now, is that it? Is that what you're really getting at?
Oh, that's definitely a big part of it. So there are two mega trends that really supersede our political geography of states and borders. One is urbanization. We are an urban species. Most of the world's population lives in cities. And yet all of the maps that we use hanging on our walls and offices don't have any people on them. They just have little black dots and borders. What I do with my maps is I actually show the world population distribution and the density of the population. So what you can see is that we are a coastal species. You know this very well in Australia. Almost all Australians live along along the coast. Well, the same is true of the entire planet Earth. We are a coastal civilization concentrating in cities, and many of those large cities, those urban conurbations, as they're called, are far more powerful and magnetic. They have a greater gravity than most of the countries in the world. Just one example is that the New York City economy is larger than all of sub-Saharan Africa. So just to put it in perspective, if you really want to accurately map the world, you would show where the people are, and you would show these urban centers of gravity with their geographic and economic weight.
And if you didn't live in one of these megacities, can you still benefit in this mega-connected world?
Of course, because beyond just the physical cities of infrastructure, there is all of the connectivity. Again, all of the railways, all of the pipelines, all of the internet cables. People now living in second or third tier cities in the middle of absolutely nowhere are connected to the internet and are working in the global services economy and are earning far higher wages than they ever would and earning more than other people in their own country and even competing internationally. And I employ any number of these people in the Philippines, in Romania, in Tunisia, people whom I've never met, and God knows they're earning a lot more than their neighbors.
You call this cutely the United City States of America. That's one of the ways in which you're trying to distill it again. But you're not talking about getting rid of nations or borders altogether, are you? Or are you?
Not at all. Quite the contrary. One of the paradoxical trends that I have observed is that the reason the world is becoming, quote unquote, borderless, and when people say borderless, they really mean connected. The reason the world is becoming that way is precisely because we have more countries than ever before. We're settling our international conflicts. We're settling our border disputes. When the United Nations was founded, it had 50 members. Today, it has 200. We have zero major international border conflicts today. We have civil wars all over the place, but we don't have international conflict. And what happens when countries get smaller and smaller? They have no choice but to connect to each other and to build infrastructure across their borders. I'll give you one simple data point: food. Every single country on the planet imports food. And indeed, they are importing more food year on year on year on year. And so the smaller our states get, the smaller our societies are, the more we depend on this connectivity. And therefore, we feel like the world is becoming more borderless. So as I say in the book, let the tribes win. Let there be more countries. Let more countries be born all the time. Because the more borders we have, the more borderless we will have to be for any society to survive.
Now, I'm just going to let listeners know that we're speaking to Parag Khanna, who's actually working at in Singapore at the moment, and he's written this very provocative book called Connectography, Mapping the Global Network Revolution. Now I'm going to go through a series of buts, if you don't mind, Parag.
Sure.
Because I would have thought that this could be seen as very utopian. This is how you want the world to be, and a lot of people have gone there before you. Commerce, you know, will govern armies, and it doesn't. And there's a rise of nationalism at the moment, I would have thought, and we're seeing it virtually being played out in the Middle East, and it's not nearly resolved yet. So, I mean, are you sure that this is not tilting at a windmill that would be lovely if it existed, and it may, but it's not yet?
No, to the contrary. You know, my work is entirely data-driven. I am demonstrating how globalized we already are on the basis of this connectivity. If there are countries, such as in Western Europe, for example, where there's a backlash against certain forms of globalization, like migration, it's because they're already inundated with migrants. It's because they have already become so globalized and their demographics have already become diluted through all of the migration from ethnic groups and other nationalities. So there is obviously going to be a response. My argument is not that full and total globalization of open borders is a good thing. I don't argue that at all. In fact, I argue that every society needs to be very careful to balance the flows and the frictions to make sure that it doesn't outsource all of its jobs and has nothing left. So I'm pointing out the way the landscape has become and where it's going. And then within that, countries navigate to gain maximum advantage. So when borders go up and fences go up, it doesn't invalidate my argument at all. It's the search for moderation and the search for balance in this connected world. And
right.
I talk about that at length, at great length.
Well, you do. And you, for instance, you talk about water in the Middle East. You energy and water infrastructures, you believe, could promote resource sharing between resource-rich and resource-poor nations. Do you have
Absolutely.
Any evidence for that happening, or is that, again, how you want it to be?
Well, there's a mix of both. So again, in the Middle East, there are obviously cases where, sure, you don't want any more refugees from your neighboring country, such as Lebanon would prefer not to have any more Syrian refugees. But Turkey is a major water supplier to countries like Syria and Lebanon, and therefore increasing water transfers there would help. And there have been incipient hydrological projects there. There is an effort to create a Dead Sea to Red Sea canal, to create a parallel canal to the Suez Canal to promote the shipment of goods through the region. Remember that Arab countries are either water rich or water poor or oil rich or oil poor. And you're not going to create more resource sharing and prosperity and stability in the region by digging more trenches and borders and fighting more wars, right? These people are generally trapped where they are.
Yeah, but I mean, for instance, when you go to Israel, you see the amazing discussions that you don't even hear about here in Australia between, say, Israel and the West Bank over the management of their water, and it becomes a discussion about power. Israel has a particular view of how it thinks it's actually being very generous. The West Bankers have a very different view, and you realise it is about who is perceived to control it and whether they devolve.
Sure.
And it gets very vitriolic.
And quite frankly, that's small potatoes, because the populations of Egypt and Sudan, which I also talk about in the book with their water dispute over the Nile, and of course the dispute between India and Pakistan and China, and then the dispute between China and Southeast Asian countries over the Mekong River, that's billions and billions of lives at stake when it comes to how we manage the flows of commodities, especially water, that cross international borders. Let's bear in mind, the water existed before the borders. So we have to bear in mind that these are actually common human, you know, or ecological resources. We do, but
I mean, for instance, you've got this amazing paragraph, I think, in one of the interviews you gave about the tug of war over oil between the Russian oligarchs and state-owned gas companies and Ukrainian oligarchs and state-owned gas companies. And you say, this tug of war is more interesting than the war itself. The war over eastern Ukraine is not a war over meaningful geography. The South China Sea is far more strategic than eastern Ukraine. Eastern Ukraine is a post-industrial wasteland. However, some of the best international observers believe that Ukraine is, you should never take your eyes off it because it could become the site of an outgrowth of hostilities a la before World War I. So do you discount that?
Well, could and will are two very different things. Unlike most international observers, I've actually spent a fair bit of time in Ukraine and a lot of time here in the South China Sea. The South China Sea is infinitely more geopolitically significant in the long run in the 21st century than Ukraine will ever be. I am witnessing what's happening in all of these conflict geographies, and my point is not at all that they will not escalate. My background is in military security and geopolitics, so I would never discount the potential for conflict. What I am saying is that every single day, what matters much more to the future of Ukraine is who controls the gas pipelines, which is really underscoring the point that this connectivity and infrastructure that I write about and map and document is not necessarily only peaceful. The thesis of the book, as you know, is that competitive connectivity is what conflict is about in the 21st century. It's the tug of war over who controls the value of the oil flows, the value of the data flowing through our internet cables. All of those things are really battles over supply chains and value added in goods and services in the world economy and sites of manufacturing and investment. That is 21st century warfare. So I'm documenting that by documenting the connectivity.
And you think the West is falling behind here, don't you? You think China has worked out this and in terms of its infrastructure, is doing this in leaps and bounds.
So we have to be very careful about that. I do not believe that the West is falling behind. I do not believe that North America is in any way geopolitically unstable. You know, I go to great lengths to document that the North American integration of Canada, America, and Mexico is actually moving forward in incredible ways in energy and resources, in trade, in manufacturing, in services, all of these ways that Donald Trump, quite frankly, doesn't understand. Otherwise, you would not think that a border wall between the U.S. and Mexico would matter. I'm sure you're aware that the U.S.-Canada border and the U.S.-Mexico border are the two most heavily trafficked legal crossings of boundaries on the planet Earth, and they will be every day, 365 days a year, for the rest of our lives, and probably forever. So North America is very stable, and Western Europe, quite frankly, is actually much more stable than people believe. So therefore, Western civilization is still the richest and most powerful, set of geographies in the world. What Asia is doing right is good for Asia. It doesn't mean that it's going to bury the West or supersede the West. What China is doing is using infrastructure as a tool of grand strategy. So I've spent so much of my time in the last 20 years in Central Asia, in the former Soviet republics, in Afghanistan, Pakistan, Russia, Mongolia. All of these countries were mega Chinese infrastructure projects, oil and gas pipelines, highways, roads, mining projects, are really redefining the economies, reorganizing the politics, and they're doing it without sending a single troop over a border. They're doing it through road crews and construction crews, and they are reorganizing the Eurasian landscape where most of the entire world's population resides. So really, Asia and East Asia, South Asia, Central Asia are the ground zero for all of my arguments because infrastructure becomes a tool of geopolitics rather than militaries.
My final question is the natural world and where it fits into all this. How does it sit beside the infrastructure you're describing? And secondly, the notion of sharing this precious resource.
Well, it is truly the foundation, of course, of our civilization. And there's a lot of risk in building an urban coastal civilization of 8 billion people at a time when we are also contributing massively to greenhouse gas emissions and rising temperatures and rising sea levels, which threaten, of course, to inundate those very same coastal cities. So I play out these scenarios in the book that are rather devastating. They would force us to retreat from the coastlines and move inward into places like Canada and Russia, places that are huge resource suppliers and food producers and have ample supplies of fresh water, but actually don't have any people. So we're dealing with some very cataclysmic scenarios around how we, that will force us obviously to appreciate our natural geography and natural resources much more than we do right now. And especially in food producing countries like Australia, you know, managing climate change is extraordinarily important, and thinking about, preserving the bounty, if you will, of nature much better than we are. So I dwell on that so much in the book, because we shouldn't, just because we're urbanized, believe that nature is infinite.
Parag Khanna, the jigsaw maker, who developed his his excitement from that Mercator particular jigsaw puzzle of the map of the world, I think, of the 14th century. Look, thank you very much indeed. Extremely thought-provoking. Lovely to have you join us.
Oh, it was a real pleasure. Thank you.
Parag is Senior Research Fellow at the Centre on Asia and Globalisation. That's at the Lee Kuan Yew School in Singapore. His book, Connectography, Mapping the Global Network Revolution, is published by Weidenfeld and Nicholson. I know that'll leave you thinking. If you have any particular thoughts, do convey them. Go to our website and you can see how.